Hey everybody, welcome back to Historians of the Movies podcast. I am your host and creator, Jason Herbert, and every single week we are bringing you discussions about history and film and film and history and everything else in between. And this week, we have something special planned for you. If you listened in a few weeks ago to the Glory podcast, one of the very best we've ever done, you heard our guest talk over and over and over about the upcoming work by a scholar who I got to sit down with just this last week. And I'm talking about Etta Fields Black. She recently came out with a book. It's published this week called Cumbie, Harriet Tubman, The Cumbie River Raid and Black Freedom During the Civil War, which is going to rewrite our complete understanding of Black freedom, Black struggles during the war, Harriet Tubman herself, every last bit of this. So I reached out to Etta. I asked her if she'd come on, and she most graciously did. Now, Etta is absolutely amazing. She is an associate professor of history at Carnegie Mellon University. She specializes in the transnational history of West African rice farmers, peasant farmers in the upper colonial Upper Guinea coast, and enslaved laborers on rice plantations in the South Carolina and Georgia Low Country during the antebellum period. And what you're going to hear in this conversation is not only Etta's research and this amazing book that she's coming out, and our interpretations of this film about Harriet Tubman and what transpires, and kind of diving into all of these things that happened during the film, but also Etta's very real connections to the work that we see in the book, to the film, to these rice plantations, and really kind of diving in to understand the lived experiences of these folks who lived during this time period, and you know, what their labors and their struggles continue to mean to descendants who live here with us today in 2024 and beyond. So I hope you really enjoyed this podcast. It was awesome being able to sit down and talk to Etta, who is now a new friend of mine. I hope that when you listen to this pod, you come to realize that she's a new friend of yours as well. This is a great conversation. So sit back and relax, because Harriet is next on Historians of the Movies podcast. Black, how are you? Good morning.
Good morning. I am well. How are you?
I'm caffeinated. We were just talking before. So people listening in are just like, oh, you just started the conversation. I'm like, no, actually, I've been riffing for a while. So, but I have to tell you, and I really, really mean this. We've recorded a bunch of these podcasts, and I have been absolutely so excited to talk to you. I only recently learned of your work through my great, great friends when we were actually doing another podcast on Glory with, you know, Chris Barr and Adam Dombey and Holly Pinheiro and Hillary Green. And we're talking about Glory and all their work. And all they wanted to do was talk about you. There is this whole, like, subsection where they just start talking about your work. And I'm like, who is this person? I need to meet this person. And then I get, like, daily messages from Chris Barr saying, talk to Etta yet? Talk to Etta? I'm like, yes, I will. It's like, I can't wait to read the book. So, So thank you for taking the time to be here and meet with a stranger. So
my pleasure, my pleasure. A stranger, but a friend of friends. So
yes.
We know a lot of people in common. Friends? Yes, we should. Chris Barr, number one. Chris is ranger at the Reconstruction Park in Beaufort. Mm-hmm. Very, very, very knowledgeable, very personable. He brings history to life. I love Chris. He knows a lot about the Cumbie River Raid. You know, he knows a lot about Harriet Tubman. He knows a lot about that downtown Beaufort area and everything that happened there during the Civil War, as well as the Black regiments, the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd South Carolina Volunteers.
Yeah, he's just a testament to, like, the goodness of what, like, our national park system can be as far as teaching people. And
yep.
I mean, he's just – and he's so passionate about the work.
Very, very, and in a
fun way, right? Like, not the way I'm passionate about Cuban coffee, like we were just talking about, like, where someone needs to intervene, but where Chris, where Chris like brings something to society.
It's a good thing.
I love him so much. He is the best. We climbed a mountain a couple of years ago together, and
really?
And then we went. I went out to. He was doing a detail out at Guadalupe Mountains National Park out in Texas, and I had put out on Twitter one day, like, and I'd never met him in person. And I was like, I just need to climb a mountain. And he was like, well, we have a mountain. I'm like, no, you don't. You're in Texas. He's like, yeah, we do. I was like, really? So we went and climbed a mountain together.
Oh,
it was awesome.
Goodness.
It was like, oh, there are pictures on the interwebs. So, yeah. all right, before we jump into this and Jason's Cuban coffee mountain climbing addictions, and this becomes Jason and Edda's extreme hour, why don't you introduce yourself to our audience. Tell us what you do, and we'll go from there. How's that?
Okay, great. My name is Edda Fields Black. I'm an associate professor at Carnegie Mellon University in the Department of History. I've written a new book about Harriet Tubman and the Cumbie River Raid. Harriet Tubman, the Cumbie River Raid and Black Freedom During the Civil War. I am so excited about this book. It has been a labor of love. I signed the advance contract. It's published by Oxford University Press's Trade Division. I signed the advance contract in February of 2020. So I wrote this book during COVID.
Oh, wow.
And in the aftermath of COVID and, you know, everything that that still means. And it was a phenomenal experience. And I cannot wait for the world to meet Cumbie and to meet the freedom seekers whose stories I tell.
Yeah, I'm absolutely giddy about this book. When I learned it, it is still, you know, so learning that aspect of history, my training is in indigenous and environmental history. So coming to your work has been this just wonderful like exploration of other parts of history that I don't often get a chance to talk about because my stuff is so rooted kind of in Florida, about 100 years earlier.
Okay.
So this is like, I was so excited to watch this film, but also just to talk to you about not only this film, but about your work, the lived experience of these folks who lived there, their descendants, which I think is also a really important thing to talk about, you know, these vibrant communities that are still there.
Yep.
As Chris would tell us, right? He's right down that way.
Absolutely.
I talked to him in the car as he was driving there. So, all right. So we're talking today about this film, Harriet. You know, I'd kind of reached out to you kind of out of the blue saying, hi, my friends like you. Would you come on? I guess maybe that might be the way before we jump into the book and things like that, I thought maybe one of the things that I really kind of find myself, even to this day, tripping over is understanding terminology and things like that. When we start looking at the history of enslavement, the history of liberation, history of humans, whether it's native folks or enslaved, former enslaved folks, Maroons, I never quite know at a terminology as far as when we start talking about Black lives in, say, the 19th century, what's the wording we should use? Because I noticed flipping through your book, you know, there's different words and things like that that we, you know, that are used. And obviously, you're making real choices here. Like, is there a difference here between using the word, say, slave versus enslaved, or is African the right word, or African American before you know, citizenship is granted? How do we approach these kind of terms before we kind of, I guess, essentially laying out the stakes of this film and these stories? How do we go from there, I guess, is the first question.
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's a hard question, you know, and I don't know that the answer is definitive. I think we're still kind of wrestling with it. I'll start with slave versus enslaved. I think the thinking on that is that slavery was a condition, right? But it's a condition, and it was a legal status that didn't define people's personhood, even though legally they were not people, they were property. So slave connotes defining someone's personhood as belonging to someone else, even though, of course, that's the legal reality. Whereas enslaved denotes a condition, right? This is the condition that person was in. And so I use enslaved, and there are times when it's cumbersome and I try to work around the cumbersomeness of it. I use Bonds people as well, but I use that less frequently than I use enslaved. I used enslaver sparingly. And some people, and, you know, Cumby, I spend a lot of time talking about the planter families. I'm talking about everybody who was impacted by the raid. And the way I wanted to write the book, I didn't really see how I could set up the stories of the enslaved people without the people who held them in bondage, right? And I do a lot with the slave transactions because what I'm doing is actually identifying the people who escaped in the raid using a variety of documents that historians have never seen before. And then I follow them. I go back in time to show how these folks ended up on these Cumby plantations. What were their experiences? The raid happens. Then I go forward in time where the planters themselves identify the people they lost. In a variety of documents. So I typically use planter or slaveholder, but there are these moments, in the moments where I'm talking about physical abuse, sexual abuse, mental, emotional abuse, then I use enslaver. And so when I use enslaver, it's a weapon. I'm like, throwing something, you know? And like I said, because I wanted that word to have more power, because I wanted it to have power, I use it sparingly. Now, the whole thing about African and African American, enslaved Africans, confession number one, I am not an Americanist, okay? I think the last time I took American history, I was probably my freshman year at Emory. I'm an Atlanticist.
Yeah.
But I didn't, you know, cut my teeth on this. So I know that African Americanists use African American and they project it back in time. I can't say that's completely comfortable for me, though I did it occasionally. I wanted to call people enslaved Africans. And when I did that in earlier drafts, I got pushback. And so the way that I always resolve these African versus African American, you know, fights is with black. Because I feel like that still covers, capital B, that covers everybody, you know, that covers everything. That's a way to not offend the least number of people, I think. Although there's still issues and questions that people in certain parts of the diaspora have about blackness. That's another podcast. So
we'll call it touchy subject with Jason.
Exactly. We're all going to need some more Cuban coffee. So I tended to use enslaved blacks. Mm-hmm. There's so many questions like contrabands in this period of history. So legally, people who liberated themselves in Beaufort and the Sea Islands after the Battle of Port Royal were considered contrabands of war. Historians don't use that anymore. I followed Kate Mazur's lead, and I call them refugees, right? And just in very specific contexts, usually if I was talking about some army, you know, special order or something, did I use the term contrabands, but more likely refugees. And the word I used most often in those contexts was freedom seekers. I used freedom seekers a lot, and I sort of painted freedom seekers backward from the time folks left the plantation, whether they were in Maryland or Virginia. I don't think I talked about Virginia, South Carolina. You know, anytime somebody took that risk, they became a freedom seeker. And all the way up until the 14th Amendment, you know, they were freedom seekers in my book. And so that's the word that I use throughout enslaved people, enslaved blacks, and freedom seekers is what I use most.
Yeah, I really dig that because the idea is like you're giving action to these, you know, by saying like this is who this person is, the, you know, part of the essence of who this lived experience is, like they are, you know, this is who they are. I have wrestled with this in my own work, whether I'm talking about indigenous folks or whether I'm talking about, you know, black communities in Florida in the 19th century and late 18th century, things like that, because I'm not native. I'm not black. And I really want to make sure that I'm doing right by first of all, by the people who lived then, right? Mm-hmm. I want to do honor by their lives, but also by their descendants, right? And frankly, everybody who's – we're trying to learn from those experiences, right? Whether or not you're black or native or anything like that, you can learn from, you know, native history or black history or anything, you know, anything else. So I've always wanted to wrestle with these – or not wanted to wrestle, but find myself questioning, hey, am I using the right terms here? I think it's a really important thing we have to think about. I want to ask you one other thing before we jump into the movie because your book is centered in on the Cumbie River. Can we talk a little bit about where this space is? Because the film itself kind of ends like the best part. I'm talking to Chris about this, you know, the best part of the film in some ways is like the most interesting thing is like the last 15 seconds when she's about to lead this amazing raid, which is, you know, your book. Where is this place, Cumbie River? Where is this?
Okay, so if you are in Charleston and you're driving south to Savannah, and before you hit Savannah, you're going to hit Buford, but a lot of people don't know where Buford is, and you're going along Highway 17. Now, Highway 17 is a small state highway. It's pretty much on the coast. When I was growing up, it was one lane in and one lane out. Now it's two lanes going both ways, so that's progress. You're going to pass over rice fields. You pass a lot of things, but you'll pass over rice fields. And you will get to the Harriet Tubman Bridge. So right as you've gone through Charleston, you've gone through Colleton County, and you are literally about to cross the county line into Buford County, you will cross over the Cumbie River and the Harriet Tubman Bridge. That is actually where the raid stopped. That used to be Cumbie Ferry. So, you know, and the Cumbie is, I think, 40 miles long. And in the book, I try to distinguish the lower Cumbie from the upper Cumbie, because I think historians know much more about the upper Cumbie, one of the largest slaveholding families in the U.S. South, the Haywards, Nathaniel Hayward, owned 17 rice plantations on the upper Cumbie. So when people talk about, before my book comes out, when people talked about the Cumbie, they were usually talking about Nathaniel Hayward on the upper Cumbie. Well, the raid takes place on the lower Cumbie, and the upper Cumbie is in Colleton County. The raid happens a little bit of Colleton and then into Buford County. So that's the lower Cumbie, and this is where Nathaniel Hayward's cousins live. So there are Haywards down there, but they're not Nathaniel. They're distant cousins to Nathaniel. You know, there are Middletons there, Blakes, Parker, a couple other, you know, families. So it's about 20 miles up in that section of the river, a stone's throw. So if you're thinking it's a boat ride from downtown Buford, the raid starts in downtown Buford. And I write about the Battle of Port Royal, which occurs in November 7th of 1861. I think I said November 11th the other day on a, was that on a podcast? Oh, okay. Sorry about that.
Etta, you were talking to other pods. I'm hurt right now. Oh, man.
Sorry.
You know what? But I feel like anything that happened before you met me is okay. We're just going to move forward.
You're funny.
I tried. Doesn't hurt.
So the Battle of Port Royal takes place in, you know, the Sea Islands on Port Royal Sound, and the U.S. Army drives the large armada in history up Port Royal Sound. The planters flee. Well, that's 20 miles away from the Cumbie, right? And so the planters on the Cumbie and the enslaved people, they heard it, they smelled it, they felt it, they knew what was going on, you know? And so freedom was that close to them. That was a boat ride. That was just a boat ride to get to where the U.S. Army was occupying Beaufort after the Battle of Port Royal. And, you know, some people before the raid took the chance to get there. So the Cumbie is a totally different environment. You know, these are rice plantations on that section of the Cumbie. And as you go up, you know, when you're leaving Beaufort, that first section is not rice plantations. Rice was processed there. We don't have evidence that there was a plantation there. But then you continue up the Cumbie and that's all rice versus the Sea Island cotton plantations, which are along the coast and then the downtown area of Beaufort.
I want to jump into this film because we're going to work our way back to South Carolina. This film doesn't start off in South Carolina. And talk a little bit about the world that we're introduced to Harriet Minty in the film early on in 1849. And talk a little bit about where the United States is, where people of color are living, as far as like, what is this world folks are living into when we were first introduced? Like, who is Minty, I guess, is the question. When we are first introduced to this young woman in 1849, who is she and like, what is she doing? What is her life's experience thus far?
Yeah. Well, she is, she's in her early 20s. You know, she has already had a life full of hardship. Growing up in bondage, being hired out at a relatively early age and separated much of the time from her family as a girl, being physically abused by not only the slaveholder and the overseer, but also, you know, whites to whom she was hired out. She's already had this brain injury that she sustains as a child. When an overseer from another farm she's in a store, and the overseer throws this weight at an enslaved boy, and instead it hits her, right? And just a traumatic brain injury that she sustains. She has already decided that housework is not for her, that she does not want to live in close proximity with white folks, with, you know, slaveholders, let's put it that way. I keep wanting to say plantations, but these are farms in Maryland. She doesn't want to be in close proximity. You know, she would rather be outdoors. She would rather work with her hands. She would rather do field work, even field work, you know, pretty heavy field work that would be considered man's work. You know, she would rather do that outside and in, you know, community with enslaved people than be in the house with enslaved women in particular. And, you know, her family has already had a lot of hardship. So in addition to being enslaved, you know, had in many cases the unusual nature of at least being together in some ways, you know, her parents being committed to each other, married, growing up for the most part in a two-parent household, even though at points it was an abroad household because her father and mother lived on separate farms. And when her father was in bondage, they're owned by different people. They're held by different people. But they're in close proximity, close enough that they're able to function as a family unit. But two of her older sisters have already been sold, right? And that just really tears the family apart. I mean, it creates a wound that I don't think ever healed, that the sisters were sold. One of them is sold away from her children. You know, I mean, I don't think that I don't think anybody ever got over that. I don't know how you get over that. But it's something that recurs in Tubman's consciousness, you know, again and again and again throughout her life. And I think something that motivated her a lot, you know, to do the things that she did. The financial situation of the planters that held her in bondage was not stable. The man who held her in bondage has already died, right? His wife, his widow, remarried. The widow dies. The widow dies later. She and her mother and siblings are inherited by the slaveholder's son, and he's on hard times by 1849. And so the economy in the Maryland Eastern Shore is very tenuous, right? It's the crops that are grown, the industries are changing. Tobacco is out, wheat, flax are in, shipbuilding, timber building, but it's not a bustling economy, you know, and a lot of these small farmers are relatively small. I think they're small, coming from coastal South Carolina and Georgia rice plantations, you know, they're really living on a razor, you know, thin margin. And so this creates a lot of insecurity for enslaved people. This is why people are being hired out, you know, because there's excess labor. Not enough capital. So, that kind of insecurity of not only being hired out, but potentially being sold is always there. It's always under the surface. Particularly in a big family like that, I could imagine. They've already lost two members as Ben and Ritt's children, Minty's parents, as they grow up. Is the slaveholder going to sell off more of their children, right? And Minty's turn finally comes in 1849. And in the background, there's this whole thing about the will, the original slaveholder's will, the slaveholder who held Minty's grandmother in bondage, and that she should have been, her children should have been freed. So that means Minty's mother should have been freed at 45. She wasn't freed. Instead, that man, Atho Pattison's descendant, sold her children and continued to hold Minty's mother in bondage. So there's also this will of, you know, that should have freed her mother in the background, and the fact that Minty herself should be free, right? So that there's a lot, you know, there's a lot going on in 1849, very close to the passage of the Fugitive Slave Act. So within the country, the North and the South, of course, are jockeying for slavery and the right that the South wants to continue to hold slaves, and then increasingly to force the federal government to enforce their property rights and protect.
One of the things that became apparent to me as I was watching this, and you know, you're talking a little bit about how keenly aware enslaved people were of the tenuous position of the slaveholders of these people who held them in bondage, right? We see this family with Jennifer Nettles and Joel Alwyn as her son, and quite literally, this family's on the brink of collapse themselves economically. And one of the things I hadn't thought of, and we see them thinking, okay, wait a sec, we have to keep these people in slavery because our economics depends upon it. Then there was also this aspect of like holding enslaved people as social capital, which I'd never really thought about before. And you see them talking directly like, if we have to sell these people, what will the others think? And I hadn't really even considered that at the time. It's like, these people are prestige pieces of these lives. Are they not? I mean, it's kind of fascinating the way people were looking at other human beings at this time.
Yes. I agree. There was a lot of social capital in holding Black people in bondage. And I think part of it has to do with labor, because there are certain labors that a white person, particularly an upper class, respectable white person, particularly a white woman, would not do for his or herself. And so if you sell the people, then who's going to do that labor? And I think also this is why in the Maryland Eastern Shore and other sort of border states, hiring people out becomes so lucrative, because if someone couldn't afford to own people, then it's like they could rent people to do that labor. And if a slaveholder didn't want to sell the people that he or she owned, because of that prestige factor, they could then rent them out, hire them out, so that their expenses are reduced, but hire them out to those people who needed labor to do the jobs that no white person was going to do. So, yeah. It goes together.
I want to talk about the role of religion in the lives, what we see on film. Minty Harriet is a deeply religious woman. This is a thing that continually plays throughout the entire film. And in a lot of ways, we're introduced both to her and the family that owned Minty's family via a Sunday service right there on the stoops of the house. So I'm kind of wondering if you can kind of speak to the role that Christianity played in either keeping these families together, or how they felt. Like, how does Christianity bind these people? What's the role of this religion in the lives of enslaved people in Maryland, say in the 1840s and 50s?
Yeah, so this is one of the things that I like about the film, because on the one hand, it shows that the slaveholders were using religion, they were using Christianity to try to make the slaves more docile, and sort of feeding to them passages from the Bible, which emphasized obedience and docility and that kind of thing. And on the other hand, you see, and this is in the same character, which is Reverend Green, right? You see the liberatory aspect of Christianity. And you see him also using Christianity when he's alone, you know, in his sanctuary with the enslaved people, using it to help them begin to think about freedom and think about liberation, and even hiding people who want to get to freedom in his church. And so, you know, before an enslaved person knew that and was ready to make that step, all they saw was Reverend Green performing for the white people. So I think in general that Christianity was one of the things that kept Black families together. And I think that Black families, Black communities, like I said, on the one hand, they're fed one thing by the slaveholders. And on the other hand, they have their own interpretation, right? And they present that interpretation to each other in things like hymns, you know, that were really about liberation, and hymns are just one example.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating how it's like, you know, taking this thing, like you were just saying, this being fed to them, saying, hey, know your place, subservience, so forth, obedience, and then quite literally using these gospels as an act of resistance and defiance in their own ways, and quite blatantly in front of these folks, right? We're singing and things like that. What are the other forms? Because so much of your book is talking about Black liberation and resistance. On the plantation itself, what are the other forms of resistance that Black laborers used to push back against their position?
Mm-hmm. All kinds of work stoppages, for example, and ways of either slowing down work or not doing work properly, not executing it well, feigning illness, right? Feigning pregnancy, trying to get oneself excused from labor, women who refused to bear children, right? Women who terminated pregnancies so that they would not bring more children into bondage, more people into bondage, and bear children who would therefore enrich you know, the slaveholders who owned them and their increase, in quotes. So any children they bore in the future would also be enslaved by the person who held them in bondage. So those were some of the ways. It's interesting because one of the things I do in the book in part one is I do quite a bit of comparing and setting things next to each other in terms of the Maryland Eastern Shore and South Carolina. And there's a lot of difference, right? There's a lot of difference. One of the things that's different is that on the Maryland Eastern Shore, freedom was in much closer proximity, right? And so resistance could mean running away. And it could mean, in a border state, getting, you know, the possibility of reaching a free state. Whereas in South Carolina, that possibility was so much further away. The closest probably in Spanish Florida. So the overwhelming majority of people, I didn't find record of anyone on the plantations that I was working on who took that risk to try to go that far to get to something that they never saw before November of 1861. Right? There were no free members of their community on the rice plantations. Now, if we're talking about Charleston, if we're talking about Savannah, if we're talking about a port city, an urban area, that's a different story. There are no free people hanging around in the rice growing regions, you know, doing work for wages. Unheard of. When freedom is so far away, people find other ways to resist.
I can't imagine like being in South Carolina. And you were talking about the idea of, like, say being in Maryland, the border's just there. Like people know it, right? People are keenly aware of their spaces around. The folks living on these plantations are quite astute about the world around them. Mm-hmm. But being in South Carolina, like you're saying, especially if you are, you know, inland a bit, the path that you would have to go to find freedom must have seemed an utter impossibility to have to find your way to Florida through all of, you know, South Carolina, then to Georgia and everything thrown against them. To maintain one sense of hope itself must have been an act of rebellion.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
I want to ask you also about this, because I know that Chris was telling me, he's like, you know, you've got a background in rice itself. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit, because this is fascinating, because as I evolved into an environmental historian, obviously I read Judith Carty's work and stuff like that. I want to talk a little bit for people who are not familiar with, say, maybe the differences between, say, rice plantations or tobacco or cotton. I think in a lot of ways, the way that history is taught, cotton is so prevalent as the staple crop in the antebellum era in the United States. Can we talk a little bit about what rice plantations are, maybe how they're different or what the labor is like, say, between, say, tobacco or rice or cotton? How is that different?
I love it. I love it. I love it. No, because this is my passion. You know, I came to the Cumbie River raid through rice. I tell people, if you found Harriet Tubman standing in the rice fields where you're working, what are you going to do? You're going to write the book. You're going to write the book. And if you don't, well, shame on you, you know?
Right.
And I felt like what had been written about Tubman and the Cumbie River Raid, and it's not much, you know, it's really not much, totally missed the rice aspects of it. You know, that these were 7 rice plantations that were burned to the ground. And that means so many things. And I can talk about the movie here. One of the things it means is that there's not a large number of white men with guns hanging around in June to shoot at enslaved people who are running for their lives. No. So a few things about Rice, and I'm going to hit the high points. Number one.
You're going to make me hungry as we work towards the end.
This is true. Is the disease environment, right? Rice grows in water, and we are talking about tidal rice plantations. Mm-hmm. So they're using the tides to... Okay, I got to go back. So you have to think about, you know, the complete deforestation of the coastal wetlands. And in addition to pulling up the trees and the roots, sort of making it as flat as a billiard table, Theodore Rosengarten would say. And the carving of these tidal rice fields out of this landscape with hand tools by enslaved men. When I say hand tools, in the early periods, I'm really talking about planks of wood and baskets. Oof. And things that could be fashioned into shovels to make 274,000 acres of rice fields, and to construct a hydraulic irrigation system, because they needed ways to trap fresh water in the rice fields and then be able to control allowing that water in and out of the rice fields as needed. Okay. So that required a hydraulic irrigation system, which had to be built by enslaved laborers, again, with hand tools. The second thing that I'll go back to is the disease environment, because once you are trapping that fresh water, all kinds of insects grow in standing water, particularly mosquitoes and mosquitoes carrying malaria. So it becomes a disease environment which is quite unhealthy for white people. White people with money, and even white people without much money, it's more like white people with sense, don't live on these rice plantations from May until the first good, after the first good frost, which is usually November. Okay. And the planter families who own them would typically return for the Christmas holidays. They'd be there, you know, in the winter time, pretty much through the early spring. But once you got to May, by mid-May, they're gone and they're going to another residence. So enslaved people are the ones who were left on these plantations for much of the year. Many of the plantations did not have overseers. They were run by enslaved drivers. Okay, so these are enslaved men who are managing the labor of other enslaved men and women. They did not work in a gang system. They worked tasks. So each person is supposed to be, according to their physical abilities, is allotted a certain amount of work. And once that amount of work was completed, the rest of the day they had free. And that free time was often used to feed their families. So whether it's hunting, whether it was fishing, whether it was gardening, cooking, you know, women cooking, preparing food, washing clothes, taking care of their children, etc. You know, people get really romantic when they talk about the task system. And the reality is that typically the work allotments are set beyond a person's capacity. And so the notion that you're going to have quote unquote free time is not realistic. You often had family members helping other family members to complete their tasks. So strong, healthy, young men and women would help older, weaker, disabled, maybe pregnant, nursing family members to complete their tasks. And if you didn't complete your task, then you were whipped by the driver. Okay. Plantations that did have overseers. Sometimes you had one overseer who managed multiple plantations. So the overseers typically are not there every day. And even the overseers are not there from early May through late November. They're not there either. But this disease environment, you know, there was all of these, all this rationales and justifications for slavery, saying that Black people, Africans, because of the sickle cell trait, blah, 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 they were not, you know, they wouldn't die of malaria. So they're built to do this work. Okay. Rice plantations had the second highest death rates in the New World, second only to sugar plantations. And the fact of the matter is that people had chronic malaria, and chronic malaria led to all kinds of health problems, including children who were born and failed to thrive, right? Low birth weight, all of that. Adults whose immune systems were just shattered. Prime hands, prime, you know, people in the prime of their lives who were otherwise healthy and strong, who just died in large numbers during the winter from respiratory illnesses, from being forced to repair the hydraulic irrigation system during the winter, standing in water, from being forced to beat and pound rice in drafty barns. You know, I was writing this during COVID. Imagine 20 women in a barn, everything is closed up. You know, of course, there's no heat and everybody's breathing on each other. How many of those women would survive the season? Not many. You know, the respiratory disease just went through them like that. Many other ailments. So, as I said, the death rates on these plantations were the second highest in the New World. And on certain of the plantations where there were not fresh sources of water, is it 2/3 of children died? No, maybe, I think it's 90% of children died before their 15th birthday.
Oh my goodness.
And 2/3 of the people died. The death rate was 2/3. The death rates were astronomical. You know, they were really astronomical. And that's from William Duesenberg's book. He's talking about the 1850s, right? He's talking about the 19th century, pretty near the Civil War. So we don't even have any documentation of death rates in the 1700s, 1750s, 40s, 60s, when they were carving those rice fields out of cypress swamps. Because it takes place on a rice plantation, on these rice plantations, one of the things I try to do in Cumbie is to try to set up these two regions, the environment of the Maryland Eastern Shore and the environment of the South Carolina Lowcountry. They were different. And I remember when I first started thinking about this project and I was reading biographies of Tubman, and they were talking about, you know, how they were the same. And how everything Tubman learned in the Maryland Eastern Shore, she could just map it onto the South Carolina. And I thought, really? If so, then why weren't they growing rice in the Chesapeake? If they were the same, there were no rice plantations on the Chesapeake and nobody was growing tobacco in Beaufort. So let's understand that.
Etta, do you think that comes from, because it sounds to me like, you know, you've spent physical time in these spaces.
Oh, yeah. Like,
and this is a thing that I often argue myself, is that you can't write really good histories from an office. You've really got to – because so much of what your work depends upon is this understandings of these relationships between humans and the spaces that they occupy and how those spaces inform the lived experiences. I mean, do you think other historians weren't doing that? Just you look at a map, go, oh, it's the South, and
right,
not really understanding the complexities of how, yeah, culturally maybe it's the South, but Maryland and South Carolina are the moon and Mars.
Yep.
When it comes down to it.
And you could even look at a vegetation map and say, oh, but it's their coastal wetlands, their swamps, their cypress trees, you know, there's Tupelo, the trees are similar. I think that's 100% it, you know, and as you probably know, as an environmentalist. My first work is in West Africa. You know, in Africa, we do field work. So I have done field work in rice fields in West Africa and South Carolina. And I actually, you know that those two, even though they're very similar, there's still differences, you know? And I wanted to understand those differences. I wanted to understand, even more than that, I wanted to understand from the perspective of the enslaved people what it was like to work in these rice fields. And I will say, I said that I found Harriet Tubman standing in my rice fields. The Cumbie River raid took place on 7 rice fields. And when the gunboats arrived at 4 a.m. in June, and June at that point really doesn't matter because I don't know what time of the year in South Carolina at 4 a.m. that it would be daylight. Okay. So it's pitch black, 4 a.m. The enslaved people were hoeing rice already. Jeez. So I had to help the reader to understand that. And then if you're in the rice fields, right, and you're standing in muck, I won't say water at that time of year and at that moment in the agricultural cycle. And I take you through it. You know, I take you through the whole thing. So you know exactly how rice is grown. You know exactly what enslaved people were up against when the gunboats, when those steam whistles blew. You know it. You know how it felt bending over and hoeing rice at 4 a.m. and even getting from a slave cabin, which was probably a mile at least away, because any planter that's smart, and they didn't always do this. This is another reason why death rates were so high. You really shouldn't build slave quarters right up on the rice fields. Although some planters thought in terms of surveillance, it would be easier to control enslaved labor. But that disease environment, it's not a good thing to live where the mosquitoes are breeding. Duh. So the slave cabins are usually about a mile away. And on the Cumbie, they were, all the evidence I found, people had to walk a mile through the grass with the snakes. Hello. To get to the rice fields with the snakes and the gators in June, 4 a.m., to bend their backs and their buckles, which were their knees, to hoe rice at 4 o'clock in the morning and pray for freedom. And that morning, June 2nd, freedom actually came.
I can't imagine. This is quite literally, I can't imagine. This is beyond my understanding of how that must have felt. And I think maybe to understand that liberation, that moment of this is over, right? This is... I don't know if this is a thing we can talk about, but you are keenly invested in this story. Emotionally, was this challenging for you to be so closely related to the work itself, to be able to go and say stand in these rice fields to do this kind of work? You know, as you're writing a book like this, is there an emotional component to this? You know, I remember Sadia Hartman talking about, you know, the trauma of the archive and violence of the archive and things like that. For you yourself, was there an ability to remain emotionally distant from the work, or did you find yourself really becoming tied to these stories?
By the time I started writing Cumbie, I had been on a journey where I had decided to let go of what was supposed to be my emotional distance. And the challenge for me was when I'm working in South Carolina. Okay, the challenge for me is that my father's family is, daddy was born in Green Pond, South Carolina, about a mile from where the raid took place. And as I started writing and researching, and this is before Cumby even became Cumby, as I started researching, I encountered on many turns my own enslaved ancestors. There was one particular occasion, and this cousin was actually not enslaved. He died in the 1960s, where I was visiting a plantation. It was a plantation that was owned by a family, planter family, whose papers I was researching, but it was also the plantation where my ancestors were enslaved, where I encountered the open grave of my ancestor with his remains floating at the top. And I'd actually gone, and I write about this in the epilogue, and I've spoken about this a lot over the past 11 years, 10 years. And I actually collaborated with artists to write a symphonic work about slavery because I had to do something with the emotions I was feeling. And I actually went to that cemetery looking for the graves of the Fields family. So this is my paternal grandfather and my father's father, right, family. And the graves in the same cemetery, so both sides of my dad's family are actually buried in that cemetery. The graves of the Fields family are unmarked. And what I realized as I was writing the epilogue of Cumby, and one of my dad's ancestors, my third great-grandfather, fought in the raid, and I didn't know that for sure until I got into the research of the book, realizing that the meticulous work that I did of trying to identify the freedom seekers and tell their stories, I was still looking for his descendants. I was still looking for him and his descendants who are buried in those unmarked graves. So I've let go of all objectivity. And, you know, from the time that I had that experience in the cemetery, realized that in some ways I have this responsibility to tell the story of these formerly enslaved people who were enslaved on these rice plantations. These rice plantations where so many of my ancestors are buried on the upper Cumby, and that I could tell those stories with a passion and with a commitment that other people couldn't tell them. And that's what I was going to do. I don't know how long I'll do it, but that's what I'm doing right now.
When I finish this project I'm working on now, I want to go back and tell the story of fishing in my home of Kentucky, because my entire family are cat fishermen. Are you familiar with like trot lines and things like that? Like, you know, I know, no. You know, if you get up there, it's like these stories that like tie us to the past. And this is what, you know, I find so relevant. And the whole idea of like tossing away this, how could you be objective about this? I don't think that's a bad thing. It's like, this is your story, is it not?
And you know, when the old white guys wrote about slavery or anything else, they weren't objective either. That's a fiction, because we all bring ourselves to our work and our experiences and everything we've experienced, you know, informs the questions we ask. It informs the sources and how we interpret them. So it is a fiction, and it became something that was sort of lauded at people of color and women and other marginalized groups who were writing history about our own struggles, right? That we're not objective. Guess what? Neither are you.
Only, Etta, don't you know that only old white men have the keys to the past? I want to jump back to the film for a second, and then we're going to come back to your book, because I feel like I could talk to you about this for hours and hours and hours. I'm so fascinated with the story. This movie takes place in 1849. We've got the Fugitive Slave Act, which is just around the border or just around the corner chronologically. Can we talk about what that act is and what that does to black communities who are enslaved and seeking their own freedom?
Yeah, it completely terrorized, you know, black communities and people who had freed themselves, people who were born free, you know, people who were living in places like Philadelphia, Boston, New York, upstate New York, which were free territories, territories with significant abolitionist population, places where they had made lives for themselves, you know, in terms of family, in terms of work, in terms of some modicum of stability. And that was all just destroyed, you know, the potential that they could be enslaved, re-enslaved, or for some of them, enslaved for the first time, became a very real thing. I write in the book about Charlotte Fortin and the Fortin family. Fortin is one of the teachers. She's a black teacher, young black woman. I think she's 26 years old. She comes down from Philly. Her grandfather is a very wealthy man in Philadelphia. She was four generations free. Okay. If you can imagine a family like the Fortins, who had lived in Philadelphia for four generations as freed people, being threatened by the Fugitive Slave Act. So not that they're going to be enslaved, because they have never been enslaved in their lifetimes. That not that they're going to be re-enslaved, but they could be enslaved, right? I mean, it was mind-boggling. And it was to the point where, as you know, many people voted with their feet and decided to move to Canada, because no place in the United States was safe for them to just pull up all of their roots and go to Canada. And for those who stayed, you know, just living in a constant state of insecurity and terror.
Again, this is utterly unfathomable from my lived experience, right? And I can't imagine what that's like. That shadow lingers over the lives of every black family in the United States, whether you are in Ohio or New York. It's like it just takes one. We've seen these other stories where people are captured and just brought down, whether they're free or not, and sold down there. I think sometimes about the long-term effects it must have taken for people who remained free, mm-hmm. just to live under that constant state of, like you said, terror and anxiety. What the cumulative effect of what that does on the soul, you know, for 70, 80 years. There's another component to this film. We see free black people in the South in this film, and we see some of them in what we might consider villainous roles, where we see like the slave catchers. Can we talk a little bit about that? Because I think people coming to this film who might not be aware of this is like, you know, free blacks existed along a spectrum of what they're going to do with their lives, right? Same as lots of other folks. And we see, you know, one of the, I guess, the big bads, I don't know quite the way to say this, is like, is it African-American slave catcher? Mm-hmm. Do we see this often in the records? Was this common?
Yeah.
I mean, what were their roles?
I don't think it was common. I can't say it didn't happen, but I don't think it was common. And if you contrast that to the fact that every white man, and this is from the most elite to, you know, the not elites, was technically a member of a slave patrol. And so the white community is united in enforcing the property rights of slaveholders. So black people, black men who worked, free men, and there were some, when I rewatched last night, I saw this for the first time, at least one man who appeared to be Native American. And so Native American, black slave catchers existed, but they're in the minority. And we could get into the whole thing about, you know, Indian nations and returning escaped slaves, and that's a whole nother podcast. But I think that these free black men existed. It's not historically inaccurate, but it shouldn't be, it was not the norm, right? It shouldn't be portrayed as the norm.
As the common.
Yeah.
I want to ask you this. We talked a lot about earlier about things that you really like about this film, specifically the role of religion in this film. Are there, when you go back to watch this movie, are there parts when you watch this and you go, ooh.
Oh, yes.
All right. I never want to turn these podcasts into a rivet counting kind of thing where we're saying that's not accurate, but there is a certain level. What I do like about this film is like we can curate this film and say, okay, this is where they're getting it right, and this is where they're taking some liberties, and here's why. So
yeah,
when you watched it last night, what made you cringe? Were there some moments where the hair stood up on the back of your on your arms?
Yes.
Let's talk about those.
One of the biggest things that makes me cringe is this infatuation that the slaveholder has, that Broaddus has with Harriet. And even the inkling that she might return his affections, that just makes my teeth itch. And it feels like Hollywood, you know. Does there really have to be a love story in this story about slavery and liberation? Really? I also feel as if in several places in the film, they introduce people to teach Harriet things. And even when the people are black, like Janae.
Yeah, Marie Buchanan, her character.
Yes, her character, yes. Who teaches her how to fire the gun. William Steele, who introduces her to the abolitionists who were her supporters and, you know, not only supported her, but they also financially contributed, that he initiates that. There was the younger slave catcher with hair. I cannot remember his name, but he becomes almost an assistant to her, to Harriet, to Tubman. And he fashions the wagon with her instructions, but he's the one who fashions the wagon that she's going to use to transport her elderly parents to freedom. Really? Harriet didn't have any assistance. She, you know, all of this was her. She had certainly people helped her, but we don't have any evidence that people were teaching her things and showing her things. Her father showed her how to read the stars, and that's about it. So it feels like it takes away, to me, some of her agency. And of course, the Cumbie River raid scene.
Yeah, that's where we're building to. I don't want to discredit Harriet's life. Obviously, that's not the point of this discussion, because she is one of the most remarkable people in history. I mean, what she does. There's an argument to be made. This, as much as we know her for the Underground Railroad, there's an argument to be made that says the most interesting stuff happens really in that last 3 minutes forward for the things we don't see in her life. So can we talk a little bit about the raid and then like what happens next?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, and I would
maybe there's a book about it.
Maybe.
I don't know.
And what I like to say is that, you know, Tubman's life was so superhuman. I mean, her accomplishments, her feats of bravery and courage and valor and sacrifice and service were just so, we can't even get our minds around them. To go back into what I call the prison house of bondage 13 times to personally shepherd around 70 people to liberation. Personally, right? To put herself, her freedom on the line. And then to go down into the belly of the beast in South Carolina as a formerly enslaved person with the Fugitive Slave Act on the line in the middle of the Civil War, and then to free people who she didn't know, 756 of them, so 10 times the number, more than 10 times the number of people that she helped to rescue on the Underground Railroad, and to do it in 6 hours. It was the largest slave rebellion in U.S. history, I argue. Largest and most successful in U.S. history, second only to the Haitian Revolution in the New World. So you want to know what happened? Okay.
Want to read the book, if you want to know what happens. But yeah, I mean,
okay.
Tease us a little bit. How's that?
First of all, I'm going to say that I found the torpedoes. There was a lot of pushback among Civil War historians about the notion that there were torpedoes on the Cumbie. And I go through the whole thing about the U.S. Army's reconnaissance on the Cumbie. And there were likely trips up the Cumbie before the raid. And their freedom seekers brought down from the Cumbie and coming down on their own to Beaufort before the raid. Okay. So I go through all of that. There were torpedoes on the Cumbie River. I have descriptions of them. I actually had a Civil War historian by the name of Stephen Weiss, who was very important to the writing of, to the revising of the book. And, you know, I asked for his input and he gave it to me. It wasn't always, you know, I wasn't always happy with it.
No, God bless the people that will actually tell you when it needs work.
Exactly. You know? And he told me when it needed work. And one of the last, this is one of the last revisions I made and one of the last documents I put into page proofs. And, you know, sent these questions to Stephen and he sent me a picture of what the Confederate torpedoes would have looked like. So I found the torpedoes and I found that Tubman played an important role in removing them and in opening the river, the Cumbie River, to the U.S. Army gunboats. Okay. So the raid left from Beaufort, downtown wharf. It left at around 9 p.m. Remember, it's June and it's South Carolina, and so the days are long, and it doesn't get dark until 9-ish, right before 9 o'clock. It was a full moon. The raid occurred on a full moon. And so that's important because that helped the pilots to pilot up the river in the dark. So I've identified Tubman's spy scouts and pilots. I tell their stories in their own words from their pension files primarily. I show that one of them was claimed to be the illegitimate son of one of the Lower Cumbie planters that got raided. There's so much drama on the Cumbie.
I'm shocked that you would say this. A story of enslavement, liberation, the Civil War, Descendants podcast. So,
and I have to give a shout out to Tim Bent and to Oxford University Press because we printed the documents. Because some of this stuff, y'all, if I just wrote it and cited it, you still wouldn't believe me.
So are the documents in the book itself?
Oh, yes. They're in the book. Really? They are in the book. So you can flip to his Freedman's Bank account and see where he says his daddy is dead and white, and he lists his name.
Oh.
Because like I said, nobody would believe me. And who, if I said go to the website, no. It has to be right there.
It's got to be in the book.
It's got to be in the book. So And they took a big risk because I think originally they were going to go from downtown Beaufort out through St. Helena Sound. Instead, they went up the mouth of the Coosaw River. The Coosaw River that is full of sandbars. In the dark, one of the spy scouts and pilots is born on the he's born in Coosaw Island. That's where they started with three gunboats at the mouth of the Coosaw. I'm sorry, they called them gunboats. I'm going to call them gunboats because that's what the freedom seekers called them. It was retrofitted. So it was a ferry boat that was tricked out to be a gunboat and two transport steamers. I tend to call them gunboats because that's what the freedom seekers call them. So one of the transport steamers ran aground at the mouth of the Coosaw River. So it's like this risk that they took to save time and try to preserve the element of surprise and still get up the river before daylight. They achieved that, but the cost was that they lost one of the transport steamers, which meant they were going to be able to bring fewer people down. That cut their capacity almost in half. So that was, you know, it was tragic. But either way, it was a big risk. So they get up the river and they arrive around 4 a.m. As I said, the enslaved people are in the rice fields. Actually, the first plantations where they arrive, they let off. The first two stops they make, they let off soldiers and one white commander each, and they hold those places down. And there are Confederate pickets only on the Cumbie at this time. So they encounter pickets there. Then they proceed up the Cumbie and they get to the rice fields. Enslaved people are already in the rice fields. There are two really interesting first-person accounts of the raid. Three. But I put two of them head-to-head. One of them is by a planter who, and I'll say this, I talked about the diseased environment. Some of the planters actually stayed. And the Cumbie planters had doubled down after the Battle of Port Royal and refused to evacuate on the lower Cumbie. They evacuated the upper Cumbie, many of them. But the lower Cumbie planters refused. And instead, they're trying to block the river. They tried to barricade the Cumbie River and then the torpedoes, right? And some of them, even during the sickly season, so it's June, they should have been at their summer homes. They sent their families to their summer homes. And I think it's three of them were actually asleep on their plantations when the raid took place. Maybe it's two planters and one overseer, because the overseer should have been gone also. And so I use these two first-person accounts, one from a planter who writes a letter to the editor about being asleep on his plantation when his enslaved driver broke down his door, basically, without knocking. The man just opened the door and gave him the news. The other is by an 88-year-old enslaved man who talks about being in the rice fields, you know, at 4 a.m., seeing the gunboats. He talks about what the overseer does when the overseer comes and tries to make them run with him and hide. And they both accounts talk about that, both the planter and the enslaved man. Man, that was the strategy, run to the woods and hide, right? Telling the enslaved people that the Yankees were going to sell them to Cuba. And he talks about he and his wife leaving the rice fields, 88 years old. And his first sight of the black soldiers, these young black men in U.S. Army uniform. And he's just completely in awe. He's born enslaved. And I would imagine, I think it's safe to assume he thought he would die enslaved. And he talks about, you know, it's like a grub seeing a butterfly, right? And never knowing that it's going to go through the chrysalis and become that. It's beautiful. He does it in perfect Gullah. Perfect Gullah. And he and Harriet are the stars of the book, you know. And what I do in part one is that I identify the people who escaped in the raid, and I tell their stories of enslavement, on how they got to the Cumbie plantations, what their lives were like, etc. He is one of those characters that I pull through the entire book. So we meet him in part one. We see how he sold, you know, in that process. We meet his wife. We meet his daughter. We meet his son-in-law. I think we meet his granddaughter. And then we see him in the rice fields, and we see the family getting on the boat. So as the soldiers get off, and they make two stops once they get up the Cumbie, they make the stop on the planter I told you, the one who didn't have any pants on. He had to pull on his pants when his enslaved driver barged in his door and told him that the Yankees are at the boat landing. And the boat landing would have been right outside his front door. They park there at his plantation. And then they park at Cumbie Ferry, which I mentioned earlier is today on Highway 17. And it's the location of the Harriet Tubman Bridge, also called the Steel City Bridge. And they dispatch people. They dispatch soldiers on foot and also in rowboats to go on to the plantations and bring people off. And the John Adams, which is the actual gunboat, the retrofitted gunboat, is the one that has the most firepower. So it commands the commands sort of the Cumbie Ferry, the causeway, which is the road that goes up, as well as the river, and it's shooting down at the Confederates. The Confederates, there's also pickets at Cumbie Ferry, which is where the raid ends. And so they send for reinforcements. Small numbers of reinforcements arrive much later. Their primary defense, there are some skirmishes. There are a few skirmishes. But their primary defense is to go and warn the planters and help the planters or the overseers, if they're on the property, to remove their enslaved people, take them to the woods and hide. That's their primary defense. And especially as you get up to Cumbie Ferry area, when they do try to marshal a defense, the John Adams just shoots down at them. You know, it just shoots down at them. So after a couple hours of this, you know, the soldiers come off, they burn everything. There's only one plantation house that's spared. And we think it was spared because there's a wetland, like, right in front of it. So who's going to cross through the swamp to get to the house? But plantation houses, stables, barns, rice mills, everything goes up in flames. And the 88-year-old man talks about this, right? How proud he is to see these young black men in uniform who hold their heads up and they go right to the slaveholder's house and burn it to the ground. They burn the rice that's in the barns. They open the gates of the hydraulic irrigation system and they flood the rice fields.
Etta, where is this movie? This is the Netflix show I want to be watching. You're telling me a story and I can only imagine how it's laid out on the page. And I'm like, where is this film? And more importantly, and maybe here's another question I wanted to get at you. Was this film comes out in 2019, which, by the way, that's pre-COVID, which feels like a lifetime ago. I was talking to our producer, Fletcher Fowl, the other day, and I was like, how is this movie 4 years old? I know. It doesn't feel that way. But also
– almost five.
Yeah. Why does it take this long? This is, to my knowledge, the first big screen film about Harriet, to my knowledge, in 2019?
Yeah.
Like, where are these films? Because I felt like my relationship with film, it's an okay movie. It's a phenomenal story. It's an okay film. Where are these other biopics about these other people? It's one of the questions I wanted to get at you. It was like, okay, are there other Harriets? Are there other people out there whose stories we need to see on these screens? I mean, as you've come across your research, your reading, other stuff that you've read, are there other stories that you think we need to be seeing on film?
Yes. Absolutely. And I think on the one hand, you know, it's of course the Frederick Douglasses, it's the William and Ellen Crafts, it's names, Henry Box Brown. These are names that we know. But I think we also need to see the stories of people whose names we don't know. And I think there's plenty of them out there, you know, and of course that's harder to do because you often have less to work with, right? Sometimes you have very little to work with. But I think that all of those stories should be told. And I think that film is an incredibly powerful medium through which to tell them.
I want to ask you about the works that influenced this book. Mm-hmm. Are there three or four books that you feel like, and we've talked about a few of them. You've name dropped a few scholars who either helped you along the way, who influenced you. As people are coming to your work mm-hmm. and they want to read more, who else should we be reading?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I would say my primary influence was Isabel Wilkerson, hands down, The Warmth of Other Suns. And while it's, she's not a historian, but what I took from Wilkerson was the audacity, if you will, to try to tell the Great Migration through the story of six people. I wanted to tell the Cumbie River Raid through the story of six people. Okay, so I didn't make it. It's more, I don't know how many people it is, but to tell it through individual lives, that's what I took from Isabel mm-hmm. Wilkerson. And the pursuit of that, you know, it took a lot to achieve that, a lot of research and a lot of databasing and a lot of, you know, these documents, planners' documents, to try to figure out whose lives I could actually track from slavery into freedom. And then could I build a story around those people? So it's a complicated process, but it was Isabel Wilkerson that gave me that notion. The other two are, I would say, Ta-Nehisi Coates, Water Dancer.
Oh,
and,
oh,
you have to read it. You have to read it. You have to read it. And Colson Whitehead, of course. Because in both of those books, Tubman is a character, but she's not the main character. Mm-hmm. And how do you write a book about the Underground Railroad and Harriet Tubman's not the main character? You know, so they were very inspirational to me to think about how Tubman is there as sort of a central unifying force, even when she's not always the center of the story. And then lastly, in terms of, and I took your question, what influenced me in the way I wrote the book? Ed Baptist's The Half Has Never Been Told. Ed has these scenes in which he writes about cotton picking and the physicality of it. And literally the way enslaved people had to contort their bodies and rewire their brains in order to be able to pick cotton with two hands and to pick it at an increasingly faster pace. When I read that, and Ed and I have talked about this, I was like, okay, he put the reader in the cotton fields and explained how, you know, he put us there picking cotton. I have to put the reader in the rice fields. I've got to put the reader in the rice fields. And you have to understand what enslaved people went through at every cycle. And then boom, it's June and we are hoeing rice.
I love it. I'm so giddy for you. I am so excited. I'm hoping that people like buy this book en masse. I know this thing is going to get just read like crazy at universities. I have to imagine it's going to be required reading. All right, let's come back to our ultimate question here. Is Harriet a history movie? I love it when I get the good sigh before the answer.
I'll say yes. And I say that because it's not poetic license was taken. Poetic license is always taken. And I think you have to meet the viewer where they are and then hopefully educate them from there. And I think there's enough in there to educate, to meet people where they are and to educate them. And I think that those areas where the poetic license is, you know, extreme, those are teachable moments.
I love it. Etta, where can people find your book and where can they find you?
So they can find the book on bookshop.org. And I would say shout out to Harriet's Bookshop in Philadelphia, and which of course is named after Harriet Tubman. You can go at Harriet's Bookshop and you can buy Cumby. You can find me at Carnegie Mellon. All of my contact information is on my website, which is www.ettafieldsblack.com.
Etta, thank you so much for being here today. I was so giddy to talk to you. And this is like one of those moments where I was like, oh, I'm having so much fun talking to you. So thank you so much for being here. This was awesome. I'm so excited for you. Thank you.
It is my pleasure. It was so much fun.
And that's a wrap here at Historians of the Movies podcast. Thank you so very much to Etta Fields Black for coming in and talking about this movie, her work, these amazing people. This was such a great conversation. Thank you so much, Etta, for being here and sharing with us all the work that you've done. I am just honored to be able to sit down and have this conversation with you. Thank you, of course, to Fletcher Powell, our producer, who continues to make this show run. You guys, he does so much for us. Sometimes at the drop of a hat, whenever I mail him late at night or text him, he's like, I'm trying to do work. And I'm like, but I have more work for you. So thank you, Fletcher, for being here and doing this. Thank you, of course, to you guys for continuing to be part of the HATM story, for continuing to share this with your friends, to leave reviews on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, elsewhere, for sharing this on social media and telling us what you want. So if there are films that you want to have on HATM podcast, if there are things you want to hear us talk about, if there are scholars that you want us to get on here, let me know. I really do value your feedback. It means the world to me. I love it to hear from you guys. And this is awesome. So hope you enjoyed today's pod. I've got a whole bunch more coming for you. It's being a great year here in 2024, and I'm so happy that you are part of it. So that said, ciao for now. Bye.